it here. The request that we give the hearing and their needs of the center, you don't do that again. You don't do that again. I think, let's leave that one.
I'm also trying to refine the draft that we are presenting. Madam Chair, and I must say, we don't want to preempt anything that the committee might decide, but we have done it in this session to maybe try and facilitate what we have gathered already, which amendments might be necessary. Madam Chair, and if I maybe go too fast, I know members have to refer now to the bill as well as the draft document that we are presenting, so if I go too fast, please stop me. Madam Chair, the first clause 1, we propose that on page 5, after line 60, that we insert a new definition, that is the definition of recycler, to mean a person who carries on a business of recycling scrap metal. And this was one of the issues that came forward from the metal recycler. And also, on page 5, in line 39, to insert before goods the word second hand. In other words, it will read, the minister may by notice in the Gazette be determined that specific sections of this act do not apply to certain types or categories of second hand. Clause number 2 on page 5 is to omit that clause. And Madam Chair, we are doing this technically. We are putting it further in the Act. You will recall that Ms. Annelies van Dyk, the honourable member, has asked that we must shift that part about the application and the intentions more to the back of the Act. That is the only reason why we omit it here, but we insert it later on. Then on page 6,
okay, may I sort of jump in when I have a question as we go? Is that acceptable? I think it's going to be easier for us, so that we should not go back to this. It's going to be easier, that
we should. Yeah, okay. There was a question by the Copper Association with regard to that particular section on page, what I've got is page 4 of their presentation from the Copper Development Association. They wanted to know why it was that any member of an accredited association, to the extent that the minister, by notice of the Gazette, exempts the members from the association from the provisions of the Act. They said, why would that be? They said there are certain provisions of the Act that are fundamental to the regulation of the industry, which is largely cash-based and open to abuse, and that registration with the commissioner, maintenance of a register in a prescribed format, and inspection by SAT, and the exclusion of certain of them from this Act, they felt would be very detrimental to their industry and resulting in complications of the enforcement of the Act if you've actually got a loophole for them to get out. So I wondered if we shouldn't discuss that.
Madam Chair, I think after we heard all the submissions that were made, it was clear that in a number of the segments of the industry, there is a sort of, I would call it, a double regulation. There are certain registers, etc. For example, the motor vehicle industry, where the registers must be kept in terms of that Act. I think the idea is that we will be able through these exemptions to, for example, to ensure that in certain instances that double registers are not kept. I think the other one was to give effect to the role of the association, because through the regulations and through the role that the association can play, it might be that that some of the requirements may be, they may be exempted therefrom because there will be alternatives through the regulation, self-regulation of the association with work that will come in place. But I think it was also very clear that there are certain minimum standards that we will never exempt people from. We will only exempt them from certain registers or whatever if there's a real, say, electronic alternatives in place. But I think it also caters for the situation that we have dealers that might be highly computerized and have all the modern equipment, etc., etc. But there might be other dealers who are working with pen and paper and whatever. So if we have those highly technological stuff in place in a certain industry, we can maybe exempt it from some paperwork. But on the basis that we have exactly the same information available, and I think it will make a life easier for everyone. So I think the exemption is not to place any lower standard. The exemption is to deal with it in a practical manner. Because I think if we can get the buy-in from the industry that we are making things easier in some respects, and I think, Madam Chair, when the objection was made that this act will bring about too much paperwork, I think the Chair made the observation that, you know, for any business you need to keep this type of information. So, Madam Chair, the intention is not at all to exempt certain people, but if through the regulation of the industry, self-regulation for that matter, they can satisfy us that they can have, and it might even be a higher type of regulation than we have in the Act, then we can exempt them.
May I don't know if this is the right place, but they did request, or one of them did, a request that the formatting that they have to utilize for their registering of individual items. They asked if that format could be the same sort of format that they use for all the other areas that need the same registration. Is that going to be possible?
And I'm saying, it will definitely be, it was specifically the motor vehicle industry. And through the regulations, we will prescribe that register. There was another objection in one of the submissions that they objected against the fact that a printout must be made every day of the transaction. Now, I don't know whether they thought this thoroughly through, because I can imagine that if you have all your information on a computer, and the policeman or even the association come there to go through the registers, whether they are going to stop their business or are they going to have a separate computer there for inspection. Those are all issues that come into play. But I can think that if you do not have a hard, and at the same time that hard copy also acts as a sort of a backup for the system. So those are all issues, but I think through the regulations as well, if self-regulation satisfies us that there are enough computer backup, etc., it is possible that the minister may make an exception in that regard. But once again, I think we should not look at only these big guys doing business. We should look at the entry level. We should look at all people in the industry and cater for their needs. If they are working paper-based, we can't force them to use technology.
Sorry, Chair. There was huge concern about that issue, and certainly any industry, specifically the motor industry, have immediately backups of all the relevant items. If they have to print up literally thousands of documents in their industry daily, it's a very onerous thing to do. But now what we're doing is putting the onus on them to request exemption for something that they do as normal business, which is now going to be illegal unless they now print it up, and now they have to go through a process of asking for exemption to do their business as they've done it previously. And looking at certain acts, and it might take months and months and months to get an exemption. Is there not some cut out? I mean, if you're talking about the difference between an electronically adequate system versus non, can we not insert some sort of cut out point? If it can be shown that they have X backups always available for instant inspection, that they're allowed an immediate extension. How can we insert something like that? Because we really can't put this sort of, it's very onerous responsibility for them to be expected to print up on a daily basis.
It sounds like it's becoming a dialogue. So I thought an appropriate thing to do, we give ourselves time to go through the draft. The rest of the discussion is for us to move on. I thought.
Actually, when I decided on the way that we are doing it now, I thought it would be easier and quicker. Because I thought somebody would raise whatever clarity that he or she would like to raise, and you know that we're not going back to them. But if it tends to be then a dialogue, then it becomes problematic. But at the same time, you can't really bypass once the member is not clear. Okay, no, fine. I understand you, Honorable Makaramole. So, Ms. Kolabanaj, are you now satisfied with the response from Dr. Jacob?
No, Chair. I needed an answer. As I say, the way it is right now, we are putting a huge expense and responsibility on the big industries, which I do understand would be necessary for the smaller ones to have the paperwork available. But they've got the electronic backup, they've got it all available. For us to insist they spend thousands and thousands, printing out thousands of documents every single day, is a huge expense and a huge time waste when they've already got it on an electronic backup. I'm looking, can we not set some sort of cutout, as we do in many instances, where you say, if they can prove they have electronic backups, they have this to any inspector, it's not necessary to have hard copies. That's all I'm asking for.
Dr. Jeffers?
Especially in the motor industry, I mean, if I take my own experience as motor dealers, they have a file for every client. The client is not buying something that costs 5 rand. He's buying something that costs up to half a million rand. They have a file for the client. They put the ID document of the client in the file. These are documents that, in terms of the industry, in terms of other legal requirements, they do need to keep. And I can't think that a dealership, one specific dealership, they are maybe buying 4 or 5 or 6 cars a day or selling maybe 10 in that specific dealership. Maybe if you put them all together across the country, it might be a few quite a couple of thousand a day. But on a specific dealership, I don't think it's too onerous. And they are keeping these documents in terms of the Motor Vehicle Act and all other legislation. So it's not really that it's totally overburdening. And I think, once again, what the chair said to us, that you are keeping these documents in terms of your business system. It's not only this act that requires it. But I think what we need to appreciate, there are also people who are selling cars from their homes, etc. And that's where there is not proper record keeping. And if a person is a second-hand car dealer selling from his home, he needs to register in terms of this act. And you will need to keep these records. And whether it's electronically or otherwise, at least a police official come there, they must be on a daily basis. You must be able to see what has happened today in that dealership or in that business.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think it's just possibly the wording of the sentence. When we get to it, we can discuss it further on page 11. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. Welcome, Honourable Sunday. We are sorry that we had to start without you. We tried our best to wait for you. Yes, you may continue, Dr. Jacob.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Link source 3 on page 6 from line 10. Madam Chair, we propose to omit subsection 4. The reason is, and I think you will see right through the bill, that we have taken out all the offences, and like the honourable member Mr. Wright asked us to do, to put it in one clause at the back with a table, and that is the reason why clause 4 is omitted there. In clause 4 on page 6 after line 18, before goods to insert the second hand. Clause 4 is after line 18.
Members, you understand this from your original thing.
They could read, even applicants intend to conduct business.
Dr. Jacob, can you talk to me? because I'm struggling to get this clause in the cases and what else. I wonder, yeah. I do have the bill with me. I don't know whether Jeremy gave me something that other people don't have. He can easily do that if he wants me to go with this mission. We are dealing with clause 4 now. Is it under application for extension?
That's right, ma'am. It's clause 4, subsection 2.
Yes.
And it will now read, if an applicant intends to conduct business from more than one premises or where goods, and we insert just before that goods, we insert second-hand goods are stored on additional premises. And you will recall that was a specific recommendation that was made. Also, in that same clause 4, on line 19, it's just the following line, to omit 4 and substitute in respect of. It was a concern that about the fact that every premises need to be registered, and we think that by setting in respect of, it will ensure that the intention is respected. And from a policy point of view, we still feel that every premises must be so registered. And I'm sure then to omit subsection 4 of clause 4, once again just to deal with the table of offences that we created at the back of the Act. Clause 5, that is page 6 as well, from line 39, to omit subsection 3, just for the table of offences.
Chair, if I may? Could I just at this stage, if you remember, the the one the retail motor street had this whole discussion about the registration certificate at each of their premises versus one registration, and if they did all have to, could they in some way, if one of their dealers commits an offence. As it sits, it looks like it shuts down the entire business. Can we just look at that? Can you tell us what the legal ramifications are? Obviously, we can't look to shutting down a thousand stores because one bad apple is causing trouble. So how is that not a problem as we've got it now?
Madam Chair, what the requirement that each premises must be registered separately will solve that problem, because if one dealer is being convicted or deregistered, it does not affect the rest of the business. So if there is a franchise holder, for instance, at McCarthy, the owner of the business will remain the same. There will be a responsible person for each of the premises, and only that premises will then be deregistered.
Chair, thank you. Then in clause 6, on page 6, on line 51, after the word applicant, line 51 is in 6.1d, to insert and where the applicant applies for registration for more than one premises, the full name and identity number of each person involved in the management of the applicant at each of the premises contemplated in section 4.2. On page
Sorry, Chair, that was a specific issue as well. They said sometimes the management team can be 20 or 30 people, and they asked specifically that where it says every person involved, if they could say in top management, or just to define it a little more tightly, so that they didn't have to put in a whole list of whom many are changing two or three times in a year, those members. So they asked if perhaps they could give the active top structure and all the names and details of those, but not of everyone referred to as management is actually quite a list these days. Is there some way we can tighten that up?
Okay.
But on that submission, we respect Advocate Jacob's definition when we were dealing with this one. We said if we have specified saying top management, the management that keep on changing every day. So what are we going to do? We agree that it must remain as management.
Ms. Sunday?
I think if I remember correctly, actually the suggestion was the directors for that specific, directors instead of management. I don't know what the implications of they are, so maybe we just need to hear from them.
If I understand the context of the act correctly, I don't think it should be just employees of that company. It should be someone that is, and I think there we might need to refer to the setting up of the country. If it's a closed corporation, it must be the members of the closed corporation. If it's a company, members of the company who are on the management.
What is the correct word? Is it director or is it management? What is it? What is it that you need to understand? I understand that it's not about every employee, but the owners of that company, it's a CC corporation. But what is it then?
Madam Chair, I think the problem comes in that I think they say that in a dealership, for example, they will have the parts manager, whatever manager, which is just sort of job titles, if I can call it that way. What we want to focus on is the person who's actually have accountability and responsibility in terms of the business.
I make a suggestion that we then maybe take management and define it within the conditions to say exactly that. Then we can leave it as it is, but that it says it refers to the members of the closed operation, the directors of the company, or whatever the case may be.
Is it understandable? Are you understanding? Acceptable? Because when she says that, then we define the management.
Madam Chair, just with the proviso that we will make, you will have to very carefully look at to capture it that it is the person at that business who is actually responsible for the administration of that business or the leadership.
Mm-hmm. All right, we give you that then. Next time when we meet then on Tuesday, maybe we'll come up with something that is the parameter of that. You may proceed.
The next page, page 7, from line 6 to the mid subsection 3, that is also to do with the table of offences. On page 7, that is clause 8, line 25 is clause 8.1a, before goods and insured second hand, speaks for itself, it was a specific recommendation. On page 7, from line 37 to omit subsection 6, it also relates to the table of offences, clause 9, that is on page 8, to omit subsection 5, that is also to do with the table of offences, clause 11. On page 8, in line 29, to omit must and to substitute with may. Recall, Madam Chair, one of their specific complaints was that there is no discretion in it, and there might be small regulatory contraventions which may not necessarily lead to cancellation. On page 8 as well, from line 48, to omit subsection 7, that's to do with the table.
Can we just get back to the must and the may? Because if you look at A, B, C, and D under that, it's very specific transgression that leads to the fact that the act then entails, or the bill then entails, that the person's registration must be on these four, any of these four conditions, it must be cancelled. Are we not comfortable that those four cases that you specify there are reason enough to cancel registration?
Madam Chair, I would agree in terms of A, B, and C, but you will see that D, 3D is quite wide. Fails to comply with any of the provisions of this Act. And I think there it might become very technical in terms of some of the contraventions. And you will see, Madam Chair, this links up with Clause 14, the amendment that we have there, to build in something where we can take correctional steps. And if whatever is done wrong, that we can instruct the person to rectify that at the subsequent inspection, if it is rectified, then we can allow them to carry on. And really, this is just in terms of regulatory, and it's not really in terms of the series. A, B, and C, I would think, normally must lead to a deregistration.
Yes,
I was going to say that the suggestion was that because it was so broad, you might have a minor administrative bungle, which actually leads to the loss of your company. So they said, look, please just allow the discretion on the part of the National Commissioner to be introduced here. So it was not to weasel out, it was a case of let us not have some accounting bungle lose the business for us.
I think we're weakening it by simply doing that. I think what we must do, if we say that we're happy with A, B, and C, then we must say under these circumstances is met, and then create another subclause for the question of D, where we say D may then, you know, he may make a decision in regard to any other provisions of that. But if you look at A, B, and C, Those are conditions that are required for the registration already. So if this guy, as we say, that those people who have been found guilty cannot register, they cannot have such a business. Now, if you disqualify somebody because of something that they're prior to registration, surely then it must be of effect when the person is actually in business and is then doing it. We can't be more strict to people who have had prior convictions and people who are going to do something wrong while they are in the business.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think we will come back to you on this. I agree with the member, especially with BNC. A might even also be a bit wide, but maybe we can cluster B and C together. And then also maybe on the basis that if there's incorrect information, I mean, it's also a matter of, you know, whether it's incorrect to defraud or whether it's just a simple mistake that has been made. So I think we can look at something there just to reformulate. But I'm totally in agreement, especially where there's a conviction, because that would qualify the person.
Our goal maybe to make it easy for you to formulate it as in A and B together and add a sentence of saying the National Commissioner then must cancel the registration. Adding A and B together and B and C together on the first number three, which saying the National Commissioner may cancel, that will be B and C. Then A and B, the National Commissioner must. The other way around.
Ms. Khorabana?
Yes, Chair, I'm very concerned that we have to factor in the possibility of human error. If a registration has lapsed, if the owner of a company leaves it to an accountant to re-register, and the accountant leaves it to the secretary to mail off, and the digits are transposed on the address, it goes to the wrong place. They believe they've done it all by the book, and the letter is tucked in the bin elsewhere. We're instructing them in case of a bungle like that, or the post office not delivering the registration, they will lose their business. There's just got to be a point where discretion comes in, where a person can actually come with a very absolutely valid, truthful account saying, we did this, we have the proof, we've got copies of the letters, copies, and where is it? So we can't be too dictatorial to force a person to lose their business for an admin bungle. Can't be allowed.
You know, this Bernard, my sister owns a cousin in Rosland. If the license is not renewed by the 29th of December, and then they are given a lengthy of another 30 days. If it's not renewed by the 29th of February, it's cancelled. They must start afresh. I'm talking now out of experience. Cancelled with everything. You lose everything. It must start afresh. Because if you are serious about the business, that's the first thing that you must do. I'm not saying that what you are saying is not fair. It is, but I was just making an example about other laws that when they were passed, we were all saying that this is not practical. But it is practical at the moment. It is practical, but I just want to say this is not the only law which restricts people to pay attention to their own people, their own business that they are benefiting from. So I just wanted to make that point. Is that not the most?
I'm getting worried. You are teaching this very interesting question. It's a law. So I thought the best thing would be Dr. Jacob for capture, whatever we are saying, see a space consolidate and reconcile what we are saying. Rather than to reduce the CSU for them.
Shade,
no.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Yeah, I'm partly covered by both you and who because here we are drafting a law. Yes. Now I don't see ourselves drafting a law and making provisions for people. So I think we must draft a law that is going to be strict, that is going to let people do what they are supposed to be doing. Because if you hire a person to do something in your company, you must hire a person that is qualified to do that. If that person doesn't say, then for me it means you hire the wrong person. So we can't draft a law making loopholes for mistakes that people are going to do.
Mr.
Lake? I think just for the fact that in terms of media coverage, and before we have another outcry about, making the draconian laws. I think it is very important that we just get Ms. Quillebonne on board in terms of what we're saying is that the must is only for those two. And the may is for A and B. And I think that then allows for mistakes that are going to be made. And in any case, we must read this in line with subsection 4, which say that the commissioner must give 30 days notice and they've got 30 days to respond to it. So I think really we cover this issue.
May I respond? Absolutely. I agree, absolutely. And I was on board until your colleague suggested it the other way around. And then I thought, no, I'd better speak. So I'm absolutely happy with that. I fear that just muddies the water somewhat. Thank you.
Dr. Jacob?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I will proceed on the clause 11, number 2, on page 8, from line 48 to omit subsection 7. That is also the contravention that is shifted to the back. Then clause 12 on page 9 from line 6 to delete subsection 5 is also the offence that is just moved to the other part of the Act. Clause 13, page 9, line 6.
Sorry, Chair, may I ask, I had another, from another of the submissions, if we could just explain to me, or perhaps define, please, in section 3 at the top of page 9, the question was, he or she has continued to comply with the requirements. They said in what way and what manner could that be defined in some way?
Madam Chair, I think the intention of subsection 3 is really to ensure that the person still comply with the initial requirements for registration. So I think the easiest way to do that is just to confirm that with reference to the initial registration, to confirm that that all those requirements are still being, that for instance, that the person hasn't committed an offence in the meantime, which disqualifies them, etc.
I'm sure this is like many other laws. For instance, the ones that I'm referring to, when you go for renewal, I don't think they just, you go there, liquor, something, and then they just take your number and fight the computer. Either it's nothing serious, but then you get your license, you pay, and then you go, I think it's worth your return, instead of starting a search. But if there is something that hinders them from renewing your license, it will also reflect them. If there is something that is not compliant, like selling liquor to under 18, things like that.
Yeah, I think this places a bit of an onus on the applicant, because the police do not always know everything, etc. It places a bit of an onus on him, but I don't think it's unreasonable, because he just has to comply with the same requirements as with the initial registration, and that's easy enough to show that to the authorities.
Chair, the actual question was, how does the dealer practically show compliance? They were just wanting to know what exactly was needed.
Madam Chair, there is reference to a prescribed manner. In other words, in the regulations, we can expand on that. And as well as I've said, by looking at the requirements and just confirming whether there's any change in the status based on the initial requirements.
Thank you, Dr.
Joseph.
May I proceed?
Madam Chair, thank you. Clause 12 then. The deed, subsection 5, for the offences, clause 13, to omit subsection 5 as well, that's also the offence, and clause 14, what we discussed just now, if upon any inspection a police official discovers that any method of dealing, recording, or transaction in registers or storage that's being used is in contravention of this act, the police official may demand immediate discontinuation of the method, and afford the dealer a period of no more than 7 days to rectify such methods in order to ensure compliance with the Act. Madam Chair, I must immediately say we have proposed this in relation to the issue that we have just now discussed on the deregistration, but it might be if we make that amendment that we have proposed earlier on the differentiation between must and may, that we can maybe take this out. Because we have subsection 4 which caters for submissions that they may be made. I also would not like to weaken the Act, and one is also wary of the issue of corruption that may come in, that when a person is being confronted that his books are not up to date. And unless you have a very precise prescript on how this warning system will work and how you will control it, I think it might take on a life of its own.
The difference just for me is that this is a temporary registration, is it not?
So, Madam Chair, sorry, Director van der Walt just referred me to the fact that this clause reference is incorrect, and I apologize for that. It should be in clause 29. So we will come to that later on if you will excuse me for that. The night became a bit short last night. Clause 15 on page 9, Madam Chair, from line 42, to substitute for paragraph A the following, and you will know, recall, Madam Chair, I think from the very first meeting there were concerns about the disqualification. So what we are proposing is, in respect of A, the person has in the preceding 5 years in the Republic or elsewhere been sentenced to imprisonment without the option of a fine in respect of any offence of fraud, theft, or corrupt activities as referred to in the Prevention of Corrupt Activities Act, or any contravention of the Corruption Act, that is the one that has been repealed, but we think it is still relevant in this context, or the commission of any other offence of which dishonesty is an element. We think that would have a direct relationship, and I don't know whether we should add anything else here, but we think with bringing in that last part where dishonesty is an element, it will cover all offences where a person has given false information for registration of businesses or any of that type of offence. And I say then on page 9, in line 47, there is reference there, it reads at the moment that as in the preceding 10 years been convicted of an offence in terms of this act or the previous act, irrespective of the sentence imposed, and was within 5 years after the conviction again convicted of an offence in terms of any of the said acts, and sentenced to a fine exceeding 200 rand. There were objections that this is very onerous, and that where a person has just been fined for a minor offence. So we are proposing to change the 200 rand to 1,000 rand, which was the maximum fine in terms of the existing act.
May I ask a question here? Could you just tell, I think remember there was a query about, let us say this bill is now passed. Does this mean if there is now and has been in your employer for 10 years, a person who's excluded in terms of the act, is it retroactive? Do they now have to go through their list and fire anybody who's disqualified under these regulations?
Madam Chair, I think it relates to the transitional provisions. Any person who has a business, and because there are businesses which are outside the ambit of the Act as well, like the recycler, they will need to register afresh, and then they will, at that stage, they need to comply with the requirements of the Act. Madam Chair, and Director van der Walt points out, and I think quite correctly so, that this is a requirement for the dealer that registers, not for all his employees. It should be registered for that person to be registered as a dealer. Thank you very much, and I appreciate that. On page line, in line 52, to substitute for subsection 2, if a person was disqualified, and Madam Chair will see it's exactly the same wording, but what has happened with the printing is that in subparagraph C, it says he's a beneficiary under a trust, and then there's a comma. Now, after that comma, should have shifted out to being in line with sub 2, because that part of the qualification is relevant to the whole subsection and not only to C. So it is only to rectify the interpretational problems that can arise if you keep it like it is printed here. And I'll share then clause 16 on page.
So before we move on, could you just explain to me, if a person is disqualified in terms that I understand completely, disqualified to hold a certificate, if that person who is disqualified to hold a certificate yet has an interest in a company, the reading of it is a bit odd to me. The disqualification is, if a person who is disqualified to hold a certificate in terms of subsection 1, A, has an interest in a company, is a partner or a beneficiary under a trust. Are you saying that they're disqualified to be a beneficiary in a trust, disqualified to be a partner? I can't quite make sense of how this is reading.
I understand that if a person who is part of a company, corporation, partnership or trust is disqualified, then that company or trust may not be registered. Maybe in terms of language, it may be a bit difficult, but I think that is.
Can you imagine if Colabana doesn't understand? How about me?
Madam Chair, we will look at this, maybe see whether we can't put it in clearer language.
I think it might need the word then that company, corporation, partnership or trust may not be registered. Even the word then right in that last sentence might actually clarify it a little bit.
Let us leave it to you then, at least a clue of how do you want to understand it. And then maybe the next week let's understand it much better than that. Okay, we will continue then.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, clause 16, then on page 10. On line 6, to omit each of. So it will read, displayed in a prominent place, clearly visible to the public. I think I need to direct this on a lot to explain this one. Thank you, Madam Chair. That also relates to the question from the legal people who had a problem with the registration of the different premises. If you take out each of, I think it just makes it clearer that the registration certificate for that premises must be displayed there.
Because when they come for inspection, they must see that certificate.
Rather than a seated certificate, but in line with the change that was made earlier, to say that, you know, it is, you know, that referring to the premises, the registration of premises, does it really make a difference?
Madam Chair, the wording as it is implies that there will be one registration certificate for different premises, and that certificate must be displayed on each of them. But if you take out the on each of, it clearly makes it clear that the certificate and the premises go together.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then on page 10 and line 7, to omit A and to substitute such, just to make it more specific. And page 10, from line 10 to omit subsection 2, subsection 2 deals with the offence that is shifted. Clause 17 then, on page 10, in line 18, before goods to insert second hand, and we have done that in other places as well where it was relevant. Clause 21, on page 11, on line 17,
Copper specifically made a point that if you look at 17B, establish and maintain minimum legal and ethical standards. Are you satisfied that their suggestion was that somewhere we should include the sentence that says that there cannot be less than the requirement of this act? Do you understand what I'm saying? If the association makes rules, it cannot be less than the act. I think it might be covered with maintaining minimum legal, but I mean, I'm not sure. It's just why I'm asking.
Indeed, I think the word minimum does give an indication that it must be on a certain standard, but if the committee would want us to, we can think it would be standard of the act. I think that will be even more clear.
So, Jeff, there was a request from the Copper Association, I think, that in Clause 17, that we added in or somehow phrased something that allows for an accredited industry to inspect the registers and goods of members, of registered members. And it's not in here, but they were very concerned that they need the right to keep on inspecting on it, to regulate themselves, as it were.
So, Madam Chair, I think it is there. If you read 17 in context, an accredited dealers association must, and then we go to see, inspect business premises of its members. It's actually not even just a right, they actually have the obligation to do that. Thank you, Madam Chair. Then, clause 21, that is on page 11. Line 17, to omit, that is just a typographic registered hand there. And on page 11, after line 17, to insert the following paragraph C. The provisions of section 29 apply to the necessary changes in respect of negotiation. And I'm going to ask Director Maralta to explain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. it was clear that the member registered of an association is not covered for inspection by the police. And one of the presenters, I think it was the Pawn Board, second and leader of the Pawn Board, mentioned that those registered at the association should also be open for inspection. And the proposal is that section 29 that refers to routine inspection by the police also then refers to the association, so that the police are also able to inspect the registered at the association.
Yeah, as I thought it was, I had it as the Copper Development Association saying that we must ensure that they must have the register available for inspection by a police official or a person appointed in terms of 32. So you say that's covered later on. So where is that?
Madam Chair, section 29 refers to inspections by the police of dealers. And we are just making this section 29 also applicable to associations to allow the police to inspect those dealers.
Alright,
thank you, Madam Chair. Clause 22 on page 11. I'm not going to go to each reference. It was just the insertion of second hand before goods every time, and there was this objection that it wasn't inserted, and we went through the bill and inserted it everywhere where it was necessary. Then on point number 10 under clause 22, you omit subsection 9, that is the penalty clause. Then clause number 23 on page 12, after 2 to insert A.
Well, they I might have missed it now, but 12, page 12, the at the top, the question about the subsection 2 that is not covered. We must just remember to insert that as well. It is not necessary to insert it.
Madam Chair, that's not necessary to insert, because the subsection or the subclause just refers to the particulars that must be kept in the register. So they are not themselves forming part of the possible effects.
Okay, and then clause 23 as well on page 12.
Apologies, before we move on. Will the manner in which this be 23 be implemented? In other words, the way in which a dealer can go about doing all that, will all that be laid out in the regulation?
Madam Chair, it is a proposal now. I'm glad the member mentioned this. A proposal that I wanted to make to the committee. We have in the terrorism legislation, as well as section 34 of the Prevention of Corrupt Activities Act, there is a formulation that we've used in both those acts in respect of reporting suspicion, where the National Commissioner may, by notice in the Gazette, prescribe the format of how it must be done and what must happen with that. And with the, if the committee would agree, we can bring in that same procedure here. And I think it's important in the sense that if a person do not report and do not give that information to the police, he's committing an offence. So that person would need some proof. And I think doing it just in an occurrence book might cause problems. Whilst if, in terms of the other procedure, the National Commissioner can prescribe, you know, that he gets some type of a receipt, etc. I think it will be a safer, and we will change it if the committee is in agreement with that.
Thank you,
Mr. Thank you, ma'am. Clause 24, the omission of subsection 3 for the penalty clause. The same with clause 25, Madam Chair, to just shift that subsection 6.
Before we skip past there, the one of the biggest problems was 24 section D. The period of 7 days that they may not alter, sell on anything before a period of 7 days. Now this was by pretty much all of the people who presented before this committee. It was the equivalent of freezing your bank account for 7 days. If they have in a second-hand Rolls Royce to sell, you're talking about millions of rands. They may not now sell on for 7 days. They spoke about fluctuations in monetary values worldwide. They spoke about the fact that they couldn't take a vehicle or perhaps freshen the car up slightly, change the same dog, do anything to it to then register the car with a new COR. And they, every single one of them said this was an extremely onerous cause and would cost them huge amounts of money. So I think we'd better look at it. Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The industry wanted to mention that the present act requires them to keep it for 7 days at the moment in any event. But and in fact, we do have a problem, especially with vehicle dealers who at the moment sell on within 7 days, so they are literally ignoring the present legislation. But in terms of this paragraph D, we can foresee that this is one of the requirements that an association's members might be exempted from if they can prove that they have proper record keeping to create that paper charge.
Is the current legislation only referring to second-hand vehicles or all second-hand?
All second-hand goods, Madam Chair.
You must also remember that the motor industry is not in favor of this bill. And it's funny because it affects them more than any other organization. It affects them, but they're not in favor of it. It shows you that if they can't even fulfill the requirements of the deals on hand now, of the X on hand now, you can imagine now what's going to happen. But unfortunately, they have to do it, they have to comply. All right, you may proceed.
Madam Chair, thank you. Clause 26 on page 13 from line 23 to delete subsection 4 and to substitute. No person may have in his or her possession any apparatus which can be used for the recycling of any controlled metal or any article or substance containing any controlled metal unless such person is registered as a recycler or. And this is the part that says, in the case of precious metals, such a person is authorized to get and recycle precious metals. And then B is the new part. Acquire or dispose of any cable consisting of controlled metal of which the cover has been burnt, unless the seller thereof is able to provide a reasonable explanation for the burnt cover, and only after the matter has been reported to a police official in the manner contemplated in section 23.1A. That was, I think, a very good proposal that was made by the copper people. Then, C, being possession of any cable consisting of controlled metal of which the cover has been burnt, unless such person is able to provide a reasonable explanation for the burnt cover. So it covers both those types of metal. Then, Madam Chair, on page 13, from line 30 to omit subsection 5 as a substitute, if a recycler suspects or on reasonable grounds should suspect that the appearance or aspects of any scrap metal offered to such recycler have been tampered or there was an attempt to alter the appearance or aspects thereof, in order to conceal the identity of the scrap metal, such recycler must make a report contemplated in section 23.1c, which applies if the changes required by the context. Madam Chair, we know that if you look especially at Eskom cables, etc., there's a lot of characteristics that are built into the wire. like colored part of the cabling that intertwines with the rest of the cable and a lot of those issues. So people always try to disguise the origin of the metal and this is the paper for that. Madam Chair, in clause 27.
Sorry, Chair, before we move on, as I see, there were two other requests that you add in items. One was suggesting that cobalt should be added in. I don't know if we've whizzed past that yet. There's a controlled metal, there we go. They say that there's a huge growth in trade in countries around us in doing exactly what people are doing with copper, with cobalt, and they wondered if this shouldn't be determined in this. And there was another one about the possibility of prohibiting dealers from being in possession of not only burnt copper cables, but also in dealing with it in order to make it unrecognizable, basically. He referred to smelting, granulating, and stripping as well, which he said were a little more difficult. But if one prohibited the being in possession of burnt copper, they would then move on to these other ways of stripping the copper out. Is there somehow we can introduce these?
I'll first address the issue about cobalt. Cobalt is under Schedule 2. So if you go to the second last page of this document, you will see that we propose that on page 17, cobalt be inserted into that schedule. That will cover that issue then. Then on the other method, Madam Chair, normally the processing of metal in terms of shipping it it's something that must happen somewhere along the recycling line. But I don't think that type of equipment is normally so accessible to members of people who do not do recycling. Of course, what was as we said to us, especially in respect of copper, is you make a hole in the felt and you burn it there. So I think there is some limitation to where you can go to really address this. But I think the proposal that is made here with the insertion of subsection 5 might address it, because eventually, whatever you do, if the person or the dealer can see, or the recycler can see that a person has attempted to disguise the form they are, then it must be reported to the police. And I think that's really the only point where you will really be able to address this issue.
Chair, he spoke specifically of a dealer. And he said the owner would have it one way and the end person would then do the stripping, etc. But if the dealer is doing it, that is the person who is committing an offence.
Madam Chair, I think that the first point where the metals are collected, I think he called it a peddler. And then the bag dealers, the bucket shops. I think we must just make sure that, you know, both at the bucket shop and the recycler himself. And I see at the moment we have here the recyclers of tech, maybe we should bring in there, you know, the others. Although the bucket shops in terms of this act, I understand, will need to register anyway. So they will actually fall within the definition of the recycler. Although they are at the right at the bottom part of the bottom part of the recycling process. Madam Chair, if I may continue, clause 27 on page 14. So next up, section 5, that's just the penalty clause. And clause 28, page 14, to insert of a certificate issued by the National Commissioner, just for clarity. Clause 29, once again, is the penalty clause that is shifted. And then the new clause 33 is then a grouping of all the penalties, or actually all the offences together, and there you will see we refer to all the offences, all those subsections that we've deleted are inserted here, Madam Chair, I can just point out that the numbering here will differ because we have put in other sections, but we will, together with the State Law Advisor, we will make sure that the numbering in respect of the offences are actually correct. At the moment, we are referring to the present one for reference.
Sorry, before we move on, there was a question as to, in relation to 33, about how these penalties would affect the rightful owner of the goods. Because if you are selling a car through a dealer and that dealer is now shut down, everything attached, etc., how would it affect the right of the original owner for whom you were selling it? Is that clarified in here anywhere? I don't see it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the main concern was with regards to section clause 33, paragraph D, that there is an order that the second-hand goods be forfeited to the state. This procedure is similar to that in the Criminal Procedure Act, where the goods will normally be returned to the rightful owner or the person from whom it was seized, and in the event that it is not known, that would then be forfeited to the state. So I think that this is quite a normal procedure.
Madam Chair, I think that will also apply in instances where the object has been so disguised for instance, a motor vehicle where they were tampering with the VIN numbers and things, and as a result there, if you can't identify the owner. And okay, then just subsection 2 that is inserted in the new clause 33, any person convicted of a contravention of or failure to comply with the sections mentioned here above may then be sentenced to according to the schedule. And you will notice that we have inserted, if you go to the second last page, new Schedule 4, and this is exactly the pattern that we've used in the Firearms Control Act as well. And Clause 42, on page 17, once again, just the rectification to insert second hand before the word good. And then on after line 31, to insert the new clause 43. And you will recall, Madam Chair, I said that we deleted this in the beginning of the Act because there was a request from Lee Van Wright that we shift this section to the back of the Act. And that is, so that is nothing new, it's just a clause that is shifted to here. Then in Schedule 1, Madam Chair, that's on page 19. After line 22, we have inserted here shop fitting equipment with a specific recommendation that we have made. Schedule 2, we have covered the insertion of cobalt, and then new Schedule 4, the penalties in respect of the respective offences. Madam Chair, these were things that we have picked up. We certainly, the committee might have other interests of policy and other issues that we might add. And if we can get that type of guidance, we can try and have it draft ready that the committee can consider by Tuesday. So this is really just an indication of the issues that we've gathered. I'm sure that from the committee there will be some more guidance.
Thank you very much, Dr. Jacob. You are working with a very nice committee. Ms. Colabana?
Two other queries I picked up. They were asking for a definition of antique goods. I think there is already a legal definition. Is this something over 100 years or 80 years or someone who feels like I do today? I don't know. But we probably need to define that. And the other one was, could you define what valuables are? It's vague. Could cover anything, really.
Ms. Van Beek?
Some two things that I think that wasn't necessarily raised by the presenters, but was raised by ourselves and supported by the presenters, are one, the issue of proactive policing in terms of the police distributing information regarding stolen goods or the availability on a database or whatever the case may be. And the second one is the feeling that we have that you should say in this act, or in this bill, you should say clearly that a register must be inspected at least once every whatever. Because we need to oblige the police to do so. Otherwise, we're going to create an act that is going to be a piece of paper.
Thank you very much, Mr. Van Rijk. You will understand, Dr. Jacob, that we expect you also to consider this written submission that you received. But I'm interested because I went through your draft. I saw that there are some issues that you've taken on board from the written submission of other organizations that were sent to my office. And as when I started here, I indicated to you that my office received a call from Telecom. They felt that they've been left out of the process. But I made it very clear to them. I made it very clear to them that Susan Peak, it's me, no one else. I decide who must come and who must not come. And at the end, I also made it very clear to them that these public hearing submissions, we send us in all the newspapers, and we expect them to respond, and they did not. And then we made it our business to write to them and invite submissions from them. So beyond that, I wasn't expecting any instructions from any organization. But I did address that with the group leadership yesterday. And also, one thing that I felt I needed to raise with them, the junior staff are not supposed to communicate with my office for things like this. This is a very serious matter. We are regulating a country here. We can't let junior staff then interact with my office. I also made that very clear to them yesterday. And after we then, you know, with people that we employ as now, they have said that you sit in your office and think that things are normal, just to discover that they are messing up. Because I understand what Dr. Barrows said yesterday, that he wasn't even aware that this is how things were being handled. But as a very nice chair, I agreed with them to come today. Unfortunately, I didn't make a copy for members of parliament, just to have a look at their submission. But I thought since we finished earlier, I should maybe grant them just to make an oral submission even without the minutes. Because when I go through this, most of the things that they basically are sold is good. Their submission is in the big file. We do have it here. But since they are here, I thought maybe we should have a technical just to give them 10 minutes to just say whatever they would like to say to the committee. But afterwards, otherwise, I think Dr. Barron says, understood exactly what and how Parliament is being run. Parliament is Parliament, it's not ministry. Ministry is something else. And minister accounts to this committee. Everybody accounts here. We account to the masses who voted us into power. Ms. Colabana?
Chair, before we move on to that, I did have one or two other queries that perhaps we could deal with before we shut down this particular piece of this meeting. There was a question about whether or not these regulations refer to auctions, items coming in and auctioned out the next day. I think that probably needs to be clarified because inevitably they're always second-hand. Pretty much always second-hand goods. I've never heard of an auction of new goods. But anyway, that probably needs to be clarified somewhere. And that also, there were suggestions during one of our sessions that trade and industry should perhaps be called in for discussions about the huge amounts of copper flooding out of the country that is actually all usually Telcom property or somebody's property that's been stolen somewhere. And we should probably be dealing with them, or I don't think we can deal with it in terms of this bill, but we certainly need to talk to trade and industry about how to tighten that up. There was a query about the definition or tightening up the definitions between secondhand and recycling, that the recyclers fall under one or the other, and there were big queries about
what was a second-hand deal on a recycler, and could that be clarified? And I think that's about all I had, except, as I said, when you said to me the 7-day wait period is already in law, could you tell me which one, when they start phoning and yelling, that I can read it out to them clearly? Thank you.
Madam Chair, the present legislation is the Second Hand Goods Act, number 23 of 1955. Madam Chair, if I may just add, the specific section is section 7C.
Dr. Gilchrist, we have decided myself and Jeremy that we will give you enough time to consider everything that has been raised and said by different organizations and also the information. Therefore, we won't have a meeting on Tuesday. We'll have a meeting on Wednesday, as usual. Because I wasn't expecting that we will be so quick. I thought today we'll do half of this and then half on Tuesday. And then better preparations and finish on Wednesday. But looking at the rate that we are doing this, I'm very much satisfied. So I think we should give you enough time to take on board everything that has been said, so that on Wednesday when we meet, we just do practicing here and there, and then, yeah. Do we agree? Yeah, that's my intention. I want us to do everything on Wednesday, even if we can sit here for the whole day, to avoid sitting here on Friday next week. Let's pay back one of the rates to her. But fine. No. If Ms. Kolabanat and Mr. King agree, then you don't have a problem. Alright, I know we're supposed to break for tea, but seeing that we have already finished, we'll take just telco for a few minutes, so that when we break for good. But fine. Okay. You are welcome, ladies and gentlemen. At least telecom is gender sensitive, not like other. I think all the structures on the organization that came here, I can't remember seeing a woman. Just one person, a lady from Business Against Crime, the only person. The rest was huge, strong. Yeah, you know, yeah, me. Yeah. I'll then give I'll first start then by just asking members of parliament to introduce themselves to Telkom, after which then I'll give them an opportunity of doing their presentation. Starting with you immediately, Andy.
I'm Lisa Vice, member of the committee, Western Coast.
We could have done it, we put the committee in Somala.
I'm a member of the committee, Western Cape. This one is the member of the committee in Hobo.
I'm Sudiala, member of the committee.
John Kalabana, KwaZulu-Natal.
Ryan King, Vesta.
All right, from there we have Phyllis Marcus there, secretary, we have Chris Tinky, researcher, we have DC, senior researcher, Madam Howard here, and then We have the strongest of them all. Don't take chances when it's near us. ET, Committee Secretary, we have the State Law Advisor, we have the Legal Advisor team from the Department, and then we have from the teams here, the committee, Jeremy Michael, then we have myself, Makwaso Soto, known by Megi, from the state. Each one was a very beautiful project to me. Yeah, once upon a time. Very nice to be a member of that committee. I mean, every time, you know, this committee. We'll take the introduction for myself. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I please accept my apologies again to your office, Madam Chair, the manner in which we approached your office, but also clearly us not understanding the process. And so we've taken a lot to heart what you said yesterday. So again, let me extend my apologies also to the honourable members of the committee. I'm hoping that also you would see our overzealousness in the plight that we find ourselves in. A majority-owned government-owned organization, but really we are in a desperate situation where it gets too copper thick, how it impacts the business, but also the communities that we serve. So very briefly, I'm Andrew Barnes, sir. Maybe my colleagues can introduce themselves. I'm head of regulatory and policy work with Telcom.
My name is Barrett Mahani. I'm the senior legal advisor in regulation.
I am Cyril Chesler. I am the executive of the Human Network Maintenance Division.
Very briefly, Madam Chair and honourable members, I thought we'd invite Mr. Chesler and Violet here. But because of their contribution, Violet especially has led the written submission. And Cyril really is the individual that is in the field that understands firsthand how this thing of copper theft is impacting the communities and the business. So I was hoping that if there were questions or clarifications, and just to really get an impression of what this does to the organization and the people, their presence here would add that value. Now, we had to respond to two questions of parliamentarians already. This year, a question was asked in Parliament, and through the Honorable Minister of Communication, we responded. And last year, a question was also asked on copper theft, the incidents, the cost to companies, the impact of the community. So we do get a sense that members of Parliament, by and large, and the constituencies that they represent, this is really a serious issue to them. And so I've attached and I've given the fact to Madam Chair, if she so wish, just the numbers, the incidents, the impacts of what it is doing to the business and the community. So the fact that it has been brought to our attention twice by members of Parliament tells us that it is a problem in the constituencies that the members represent. And my concluding comment is simply this, that we are looking to the Second Hand Good Act as a means to really help us at least start to address the problem of copper theft. We have the statistics here for the incidents and the impact, and the fact now that when the telephones and the data networks are down, it also impacts the bad quality that we give to people. People become angry. It's just a big social implications on all. But we're hoping that the excellent work that this committee will what I, when I spoke to Madam Chair yesterday, just to get an impression, we here, first of all, just to apologize, but secondly, just to say, in the draft bill, we see a means to help to start to address this problem in a meaningful way. And if there are any questions, then the team and the panel would really like to respond. I'm going to ask Violet just maybe just for 2 minutes just to speak to some of the broad issues, some of which now, because we were privy to sit here, we got a sense many of those things is being captured, is being considered. And then I also would just like Cyril just to speak just an impression of what they're just for 2 or 3 minutes. Then if there are specific questions and the time would allow, then we can go into more detail. So thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I hand over to Violet.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will start with the general comments on the draft bill. Firstly, we believe that Section 23(1)(c) of the bill will be applicable to other cables that have been altered by being or being stripped of the identifier mask or shifting, especially when offered to the dealers. We also have the view that the seller's details that are submitted to the dealers, that they will be put on the central database so that the police can be able to inspect. And also under the specific comments on the bill, we'll start with the definition. And we believe that the definition of communication should be replaced with the term electronic communication, to ensure that, you know, that is in line with the terminology that is widely used in the Electronic Communications Act, the definition of 2005. And also the definition of dealer doesn't, we believe that it doesn't make provision for those.
Can I just interrupt you? In your package, you have the last page in your package, I mean the last presentation in this package. You see it written telecom something something. You may continue to okay, the bill only refers to wireless, but I first to refer to fixed as well. And on the definition of going to the definition of dealer, we realize that, you know, it doesn't make provision for those instances where an individual or a business deals with second-hand goods on a once-off basis. So we feel that, you know, this should be included because there might be people who just deal with, you know, just get the second-hand goods and sell it, you know, on that basis. And the other definition is regarding the person, and we say that it should include both natural and juristic persons, and that should include, without limitation, the companies, the sole corporations, trust, consortia, etc., instead of just being limited. And the other definition that we feel that should be revised is the definition of premises. This is mainly because the, you know, a second-hand goods dealer may carry out this electronically or otherwise. So they, it's not necessary that, you know, there should be, you know, premises or, you know, where, you know, that should be, there should be premises. Moving forward to the specific, just to add on that, the definition of sub-metal dealer doesn't include an agent or an employee employed by a sub-metal dealer. We thought that, you know, it would be beneficial to include that because in some cases you might employ an agent to carry out your business. Moving forward on the draft bill, we just under the specific comments, especially the clauses, this has been covered section 6386 regarding the fines. We just noticed that, you know, there's a schedule that has been added in there. Then the effect of registration, which is section 8(1) in the bill, we propose that Telkom, the prescribed certificate of registration to the dealer must also make provision for the date of registration. If you look in the bill, there is no provision for date of registration. important that we effort, you know, to make sure that, you know, we can stay better. Section 11.3, which deals with termination and cancellation of registration, we recommend that it should be extended to apply where a director, a partner or trustee has been convicted under this act for an offence that involves dishonesty. Section 22, which deals with the records by dealers, Section 22 makes reference to the fields that must be included in the register that are normally kept by the dealer. But it's not clear whose information should be provided in the instance where goods are obtained from the business entity. We feel that, you know, that should be clarified, that whether the information should be the director's information or maybe, you know, any employee that is employed in that company. Section 22.5 provides that the dealer must obtain and keep a copy of the identity document, but it fails to indicate that the transaction concerned must be linked to the specific document. So we feel that, you know, there must be it must be important to have a choice of details with regard to that transaction. Moving forward, still under the clauses, Section 29 deals with the routine inspection. We feel that the powers of the police may be limited when conducting inspection. So we suggest, we recommend to the committee that Section 29.1 must be extended to give power, to give the police the power to enter premises, especially in instances where there is a reasonable suspicion that a crime might be committed. For the police to go and request a warrant, it might take some time, especially where they are, there is a suspicion. So we feel that they must be empowered to just enter the premises and inspect. Section 30, which deals with entry, search, seizure, and seal off. We recommend the addition of the clauses dealing with instances where the powers of the police, the powers of the police should be extended to summon persons that are loitering around suspiciously, especially around the first major dealer's premises. We feel that they must be called in by the police to be questioned. And if there is suspicions that, you know, they might be there to commit some crime, that they be called into to the police station. Thank you. On that, I will hand over to Cheryl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I said earlier on, I am here with Human Network Relations Division, so I've got the customer and festival administration. As of yesterday, we have 20,000 customers out affected as a result of theft. Of which 20,000 is more than a month in terms of without service for more than a month. And maybe just to clarify the question of more, you know, without service for more than a month, because our aim is to have an installed service within 24 hours. These are areas where cables have been stolen on more than 10 occasions. And the quicker you repair, the quicker it gets stolen. And if you look at our network, we started building this network in the past 40, 50 years, and there was quick deployment network. Especially when we still had an exclusive failure, where we had targets to add certain number of customers to it. And one quickest way of deploying was overhead routes, because we didn't have the through pavement, which is lengthy, figure to track. And those are the now most valuable methods. Because aerial cable is the most stolen cable. Of our sales, 80% is overhead network. And it covers wide ranges. And my colleague Baron has mentioned in terms of our submission to Parliament in calls that answer certain questions based on the complaints from the wider community in terms of customers being affected by the theft. I've also attended a meeting with the agricultural union, the agricultural union in Northwest, and we are still in a meeting with the cultural union, agricultural union, because one group of people that were affected by this is now getting so commercialized and more difficult to even deploy alternative technology because of white people in the agricultural sector. And my feeling is that this deal will assist us, because it becomes so difficult when a farmer tells you, especially at this season, that I deal with international people and I cannot be contented because of the copper problem and West office have got no cell cover. So, to me, I want something to tell the committee for advice for promoting us the opportunity for us to stress upon the importance and effect of this people there on our current country.
Thank you very much, Dr. Barenta and your team. Members, that's a short and very clear presentation from Telkom. I recognize Ms. Korabana. There will be some charges and questions that will be asked by members of Parliament. Ms. Korabana, Ndadiye Mwase, Mr. Ngeta. Ms. Korabana, floor is yours.
Sorry, I think she's killed that microphone. Chair, on page 4 of the presentation, they're proposing the changing of the definition of a dealer to include any individual who sells, in this case, a second-hand item on a one-off basis. Now, that may be a mean to, I mean, if they for a moment imagine that a criminal stealing their copper wiring is going to pay any mind at all to this act, well, they're not. I mean, this is the police know what they're looking for, but this, in fact, would take such an enormous burden on the individuals in South Africa if any one of us wishes to sell one old washing machine in 1 year or any item as a one-off to get it out of your house. You're now, by changing that definition in that manner, going to have to register as a dealer and go through all the loops and stuff. So I just don't see that is even something we could begin to contemplate.
It's the same thing that stolen copper is a worrying factor and it affects the whole country and so on, and in particular it has a business people and telecom people. I would like to know from the telecom people whether they have any, because of their act, want to try to assist them, whether they have anything preventative measures they are applying themselves, what is it that they are trying to do in order to prevent that itself.
I would like maybe to appreciate in your submission the power that you support the idea of the power to be given to police to do inspection wherever they suspect the theft. But I just want to check as a legal person that submission is probably not going to be a duplication to other legislation, like maybe in France and other, like I haven't checked, but you are a legal person, I just want to check notification of maybe given a power to police. Maybe there is a legislation issue in there, if she's mostly given power to those police. And also I haven't heard you, I've heard you saying the registration must be expanded to some other premises. If you can elaborate more, which premises, I didn't understand, and when the deal is being done electronically, where the goods get kept, if you can elaborate more on that.
Alright, I'll give you an answer to the question.
I will start with the definition of a dealer, where we saw that in
case mainly based on, it refers mainly to stolen copper, because we deal with instances where you find that, you know, there's a syndicate or maybe just an individual out there who decides, you know, that, you know, on that day they go and strip off copper and go and sell it. So we feel that, you know, in that case, they should be included in the case. Because sometimes they just believe that on that day, you know, it should just be a once-off transaction instead of being, you know, something which is which might be regarded as, you know, an ongoing business.
Can I address you on that one? I understand where you come from. I understand your position. But the problem is we are regulating for everybody, not specifically for temple. And secondly, we want to make life very difficult for those who buy the copper from property. So if there is no market for the fee to sell that copper, so it's obvious that at least we try to eliminate the criminality when it comes to copper. I just want to see that's on the table.
Thank you.
I think the second question related to the methods we are using currently in terms of our nation. Yes, we have got alarms in our nation, but because of the vastness of our area, because we're talking of millions of kilometers, those people will see the patrol vehicle passing, and they will know that it will take an hour before it comes back. So although the alarm will be activated in the control room, and the vehicle being called back, they would know that by the time it comes back, that cable will be closed. And worse in terms of open wire routes, which is the old route, basically feeding the farm area, because it's kilometers between farms, Northern Cape especially, you will travel kilometers and kilometers before you find the next farm. So as much as they eat, we've got security companies, we've got alarms, but the amount of routes that we have, million kilometers of road, you cannot cover everything at every given time.
Even your advert on Easy News, you are trying your best.
Also, just before Violet responds to the last two, the one in extension, premises and the one on duplication of powers, I just want to also say something about prevention. We've looked at the possibility of having copper cable testing classified as sabotage. We also looked at it being declared as semi-precious metal. So we are really saying what policy and regulatory instruments, means, tools can be used to address this multifaceted, complex and dynamic problem, in addition to the preventative measures that my colleague has alluded to. So we're looking both practical issues, security guards, and alarms, and incentivizing the communities and so forth and so on. We're also looking at the policy and regulatory areas to see what else can we do to really address the issue. And if you look at the incidents and if you look at the costs and the numbers, it is safe to say that we're trying, we're working hard at it, but it's really very difficult to contain. And we see within the bill a means and instrument to start really addressing it in a meaningful way. As the chair now has alluded to, particularly if you look at the supply of the material, how do we address that in the meaningful way? We think with the buyers and by resolving them, those that are selling, that will be one step to help us address this multifaceted problem. So over to my colleague, please.
With regard to other powers of the police, I believe that, you know, if we are referred to their powers in this particular bill, that should suffice instead of I believe well that, you know, there might be other powers out there. They might be regulated by some legislation out there which gives them more power. But I think in this act we must at least try to some extent to not to limit their power.
on the premises, the issue regarding premises, where we say that it must be expanded to include whether electronic or otherwise. You might find that, you know, in some cases, people work with, you know, they get an order, and thereafter, you know, they might advertise that, you know, this is what I'm selling, and get an order, and then decide, you know, that day that, you know, they will go somewhere to strip off copper or get something, and sell it. You know, they don't necessarily have to have a warehouse where they keep them. So now we say that, you know, if you are known to be trading there, or if you are trading in secondhand goods there, you know, on order basis, then you should be, you know, you should be included in the definition.
This is not a question related to telco, but it's something that I don't want them to answer, but that I want the department to answer. But it's telecom thing here that actually brings this up in my mind. How do we make provision for the sale of second-hand goods via the internet? I'm sorry to put in a whole new thing, but I mean, you go to, you've got Bid or Buy, you've got all these websites where you can actually sell second-hand goods.
Saying that, I see you, director and commissioner, they look at each other, they laugh. I'm sure they're so ready for that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, we're not so ready for the question, but we considered the possibility, and also what the legal representative from Telkom now mentioned was when people sell things on an order basis, but the definition of dealer will still require that person be registered, and that person must physically sit somewhere, and that will be the premises that is registered. The goods may not necessarily be on the premises, but the sufficient registers still have to be kept on the premises. So they will be required to take all the steps that are required of them in terms of the act, although they are not physically in possession of the goods.
Just put here now, we want to finish. I think if that's the case, then we need to somewhere put in that this act also refers to electronic sales of second-hand goods, because it's not in the definitions, it's nowhere. And I must be honest, I don't know whether it's going to work. For the simple reason that, you know, on just visit the News 24's Bid or Buy and see, it's there are thousands of items, there are thousands of people bidding, there are thousands of people selling, but I mean, I think if it is going to, then we need to be specific about the fact that it also refers to electronic transactions on the internet.
Thank you, Ms. Sandrine. I'm sure that you have been answered all the questions that you responded. Yeah, thanks very much. Thanks to members of Parliament. I'm impressed that members of Parliament haven't shown any anxiety to go home.
Kim, I'd like to ask two last ones before we all take off into the wild beyond, and it's got nothing to do with telecom right now.
Okay. There was an issue 22.4 where it asks that anybody who buys anything that's secondhand must supply IDs and all that, and it was pointed out that if someone comes in and wants to buy a 4 rand Tupperware and doesn't own an ID book, that actually precludes them from buying it. It could be quite an onerous thing to put in there. It's now, I mean, you're not asked to produce an ID if you buy a Tupperware at any other retail store. Why is this in here? I think that is, in fact, is absolutely unnecessary. I don't know why it's there. And I just want clarity on this business of the actually state daily printout of everything you've done. Dealers are presuming that is over and above the client files that they have, because it specifically says print out daily everything you've done, even though you've got files for everybody. Maybe we could just reword it to
to be more specific. If you have the relevant paperwork, that's it. You don't have to then go back and duplicate and reprint everything you've done during the day. And also, one clarity, also the appearance, 24.D. You know, they made such a noise about all this, oh, we can't do anything on a car for 7 days. Can't touch the car. I've read it and read it and read it, and I don't read it like that at all. It just says there, don't alter the appearance of the vehicle. I'm going to send it for, you know, to have the shocks upgraded and a few other things. There's a change in the appearance. So I don't know, were they just blowing smoke or what were they talking about? I was interested.
No, I think Dr. Jacobs and your team, you will talk about everything that has been said here. I think in some instances we were totally misunderstood. Because there was a time where that's where it was said by one organization. You know, with the kind of the reaction time of the police, we keep a person here for more than, I don't know how many hours. There is nothing that requires the police. If a person comes in and said and sell a cover table to you, I mean, does that person own a factory where he's producing that? No. Why should we buy? And there is nothing that requires police there. You can't say that person must wait for the police to come and all that thing. If, of course, you suspect that it's a stolen property, then it's your duty to see if that something is being done about it. And then you must put the blame on the police, as you said. So I agree with you, Ms. Kolabana, that in some instances, I think there is not an understanding the act at all. Thank you very much. We've come then to the end of the meeting. I know we're rushing for our flights, and there is no meeting on Tuesday. We'll be meeting on Wednesday, same time. Jeremy will communicate to you about the venue. And please, Dr. Jacobs, we are expecting to finish on Wednesday. We'll do the deliberation clause by clause. We'll finish that. We adopt the report about this specific piece of legislation so that then we can just ask Parliament to give us a slot for the debate. Are we in agreement of that? Thank you very much, and the meeting is
okay.